I had the privilege last week of going to St. Mary's Seminary in Cleveland, and I gave a lecture there, but I also spoke to the seminarians. And I used the sort of context of King David, because I've been working on this commentary on 2 Samuel. And I'm deriving from the David story certain principles for priestly spirituality. So I thought I'd share some of that. You know, a lot of seminarians and priests watch the videos, but I think really anybody interested in the spiritual life could draw some inspiration from the story. I talked first about David as someone who listens to the Lord. One thing that's clear now in all of 1 and 2 Samuel is David at his best is someone who listens to Yahweh. What does the Lord want him to do? Keep in mind, David is anointed by Samuel kind of out of the blue. You know, he tells Jesse, go find your sons, and no, it's not him, not him. And finally, the youngest one comes, and Samuel anoints him. The Spirit rushes upon him. David wasn't a member of a royal family. He wasn't an aristocrat. He was a shepherd kid, you know. But he was called by this higher power. Then throughout his life, at his best, David, even in small matters, consults the Lord. In other words, he places his will in the context of a much higher will, the will of God. St. Paul says in Ephesians, you know, there's a power already at work in you that can do infinitely more than you can ask or imagine. There's a whole spiritual program in that. Because most of us are into autonomy. We're into our own will. I decide. It's my project. It's my life, my plans. But the Bible is always telling the opposite story. That your little projects and plans are nothing compared to what God wants to accomplish through you and with your cooperation. David goes wrong, by the way, precisely when he falls into that autonomous stance. The key to happiness, and I'll go out on a limb here, I mean for anybody, is just that, is to realize it's not the ego drama, that's your little drama, you're the producer, director, and star. It's the theo drama that matters. It's God's drama. God's the director. God's the producer. You're in it. Maybe you're not the star, though. You've got a role to play, and the idea is to find out what that is. There's a move into a passive stance. And I know right away we don't like that. Passive's bad. Active's good. But see, now we're dealing with God. God is that power who wants nothing but what's best for you. Therefore, a surrender to God is a surrender to your own best self. Now, that's a high paradox, but it's right at the heart of the biblical revelation. David is someone who, at his best, does that. He listens. Keep in mind, too, that Israel is defined, really, as a people who listen. Adam's problem, and I read that story symbolically, Adam's problem is he didn't listen. So the Lord told him what to do, what not to do, but he set off on his own path. God begins the rescue operation by forming a people, Israel, after his own heart. The first member, the founder of that family, is Abraham, who hears the voice of the Lord, and we hear the Bible, listens to it. See, and that's always the key to Israel. It's a people that listen. That's why in Deuteronomy 6, the great Shema prayer, hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is God alone. That's why Paul says in Romans that faith comes from hearing. See, it's not just a propositional statement. It's about this shift in attitude. I'm not running my life. Rather, I listen to a higher voice. So that's the first lesson, I think, from David. Here's the second one. And maybe especially now for priests and seminarians. David is the sweet singer of Israel. And that beautiful phrase, that's the King James translation of the Hebrew. He's the sweet singer of Israel. First thing we hear about him in 1 Samuel is that he's a singer. He goes to Saul, remember, to soothe Saul, who is this kind of going very disquieted person. And David plays and sings for him. Of course, David delivers himself of that gorgeous elegy for Saul and Jonathan when the two of them are killed on Mount Gilboa. How the mighty have fallen on the heights, and a beautiful poem. Think of young David before Goliath, who speaks that magnificent, you know, speech in defiance of Goliath, and the Israelites overhear him. In the very end of 2 Samuel, we have essentially it's Psalm 18, but placed in the mouth of David, and he sings this gorgeous song to God. And of course, he's associated with all the Psalms. You know, how many actually go back to David? Who knows? Maybe some of them do. But he's associated with the Psalms. He's the sweet singer of Israel. He gives voice to the deepest aspirations of the people. Well, every priest, seems to me, has to be a sweet singer. A big part of a priest's job is to give voice to the things of God, to give voice to the longings of the people. Oftentimes, all you've got as a priest are words. You know, to bring to someone's suffering, to bring to someone's pain, to bring to a difficult situation, to bring to a joyful situation. You sing forth these deep truths. Not only in sermons, but maybe primarily in sermons, but every time you counsel someone, every time you visit someone in the hospital or nursing home and you bring a word of healing, a word of truth. Maybe it's a harsh word. Some poetry is harsh. Maybe it's a word that someone has to hear. But you have to sing. You've got to be good with language, I think, to be a priest. Aristotle long ago said the three great things you need to be a persuasive speaker are logos, pathos, and ethos. Not the Three Musketeers, they sound like it, but it's the logos, word, logic, reason. Persuasive speech should be reasonable. One of the problems we have, I think, in preaching is just that, that it's a lot of bazooing and not a lot of ordered speech. One reason speech is interesting and persuasive is that it's structured. There's a beginning, middle, and end. There's an argument. There's a conclusion that you're drawing your listener to. So logos is key. But secondly, pathos, which is feeling or passion, right? Aristotle said that people only listen to an excited man. So what he means is that if you can't get excited about it, you know, then why should someone else get excited about it? Why should someone else pay attention to it if you can't communicate some passion for it? So one problem with homilies, they might be logical in some cases, but they have no pathos behind them. They have no feeling. Fulton Sheen, you know, used to say the priest should not work with a text. And his line was, you know, well, good God, man, if you can't remember it, how do you expect me to remember it? You know, and so the idea is that you enter into it with all of your pathos as well as logos. And then finally, I told the seminarians, the most important for Aristotle is ethos, which means character. It's the character of the speaker that makes the speech persuasive. One thing that especially young people can sniff out in a second is a phony, is a hypocrite. One reason John Paul II, even when he's an old man, you know, very infirm, barely able to speak, but was able to hold the attention of young people all over the world, one reason for that, I think George Weigel said correctly, is they sensed his integrity. Even though he wasn't flashy at that point in his life, earlier he was, he had more, you know, kind of charisma, but at the end he wasn't a flashy figure, but they knew he was dripping with ethos. He was dripping with character, and that made him compelling. So logos, pathos, ethos are key to being a sweet singer of Israel. Every preacher is a sweet singer of the new Israel, the church. Think of Churchill or Lincoln, you know, at key moments in their nation's history, all they had to bring really was language, but that hugely impacted the country they were leading. So Lincoln at the Gettysburg Address, I mean, how many remember Lincoln's strategic moves in the Civil War? But everybody remembers the Gettysburg Address, because at that point he was a sweet singer of America. Or Churchill in 1940, you know, when literally all they had was language, and he brought to bear, you know, I'll give you blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We'll fight on the beaches, we'll fight on the streets. You know, I mean, he was a sweet singer of Great Britain at its moment of great crisis. So that's key to David. It's key to any priest in the church, I think. Third thing I reflected on was David and Saul. It's one of the most poignant passages, really, in the whole Old Testament, I think. You know that Saul brought David in to sing to him. Saul commissioned him to go and fight Goliath. Saul loves David in one sense, and he makes him captain of his army, etc. But then there's that dreadful moment when the women come out to greet David and Saul, and they sing, Saul slew his thousands, but David his tens of thousands. And right away, the dark spirit comes upon Saul, the dark spirit of envy, of resentment, of jealousy. You know, here's this kid, I've made him what he is, I put him in place, and now he's over me, and boy, now he wants to be king. At that point, Saul begins to conspire against David, even throws spears at David, eventually sends an army after him. And it's a terrible moment in the story because Israel is battling the Philistines. Symbolic now of the church's battle against sin and death and all the powers of negativity, right? So the Philistines are kind of a symbol of all that up and down the ages. Israel's meant to battle them in the name of God. The trouble is now Israel's fallen into war with itself, which means they're making no progress against the Philistines. See, that's the best way for the Philistines up and down the ages to today to defend themselves, is to sow the spirit of discord among the Israelites. So Saul and David fight each other, and eventually David, you know, is forced to become a traitor. Really, he goes into the hands of the Philistines. It's a bit like at the height of World War II, Churchill becoming a Nazi. I mean, it's an extraordinary part of the story. David actually goes over to the Philistines. You see what your jealousy can do? Your jealousy can make a good person bad. It can drive a good person to a kind of madness or distraction. But the lesson I was drawing out for the students and for, you know, pre-seminarians, really anybody listening, is this is just the worst thing that we can do as a church, is to allow the spirit of rivalry, jealousy, to overtake us. You know, I'm not picking on any particular chancery office or diocese. It's just the way human beings are. But, you know, a good idea will surface, let's say. And it really is a good idea. It really will help the people of God. It really will benefit the church. But it goes into the maw of a bureaucracy that's often characterized by rivalry, jealousy, turf wars. It wasn't my idea. I didn't get the memo. How come you're doing that? I'm supposed to be doing that. And before you know it, the church is at war with itself. Or think of happens all the time, you know, a young hotshot priest arrives in a parish. And he's like David. Maybe he's charismatic, he's a good speaker, the people all love him. And before you know it, the people are singing some version of, well, Saul slew his thousands, but David is tens of thousands. Oh, we love Father or Pastor, but oh, this new priest, we really like him. That can lead to the same problem, you know. One of the great graces of my own life was my first pastor, Father Joe Kinane, who was a great man, allowed me, when I came on the scene as a young guy, you know, and he rejoiced in that. He rejoiced in the fact that people, you know, liked my preaching or liked what I was doing, and he never tried to block me or stand in my way, but he kind of reveled in it, realizing, look, we're on the same team here, you know, and you're fighting the battle I'm trying to fight, so let's do it together. I told the students in Cleveland that, you know, maybe some of them will arrive in the parish as David, but they might grow up to be Saul too. You know, the time will come when another figure arrives. What do you do with that? See, the medieval doctors said that the worst form of invidia, that's envy, is invidia clericalis, clerical envy. And I think that's right, even to this day. The worst form of jealousy can be clerical jealousy. Look, we're fighting on the same side here. You know, Harry Truman said, and this line's always stayed in my mind, he said, there's no limit to what we could achieve politically if no one cared about who got credit. And it applies across the board, doesn't it? There's no limit to what we could achieve as a church if no one cared who got the credit for it. That's a lesson from the David-Saul battle.